It's the lazy, hazy, okay, maybe not so McCrazy anymore days of summer. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Great to be back with you today. We're doing this on Friday, and I can tell you that the weather has been very interesting here in that I was sitting here waiting to get started this morning, and the heavens opened up, and my wife and I were communicating, despite the fact that we're about 50 feet apart in two different buildings. We were communicating by text because the rain was coming down in literally in buckets, and any foray outside the door would have been instant soak down. I almost would have had to put on a pair of nose pinchers or maybe a scuba outfit to step out in it. So you never know what it is. We do live in Central Ohio, folks.
Yeah, well, it isn't just Central Ohio, Chuck. Southern Ohio does the same type of thing. So yesterday seemed to, we're recording this Friday morning, and yesterday seemed to be a deluge down here. It rained all day long, which is nice and fine because this weekend I was hoping to get out to do some weed pulling and cleaning up around the property. So I appreciate that. It soaks things down and makes it easier to pull the weeds out of the ground. So well,
that's true.
I'm pretty happy about that. And I'm pretty happy about another thing, too, Chuck. It's pretty much a given that once, you know, when we're here in the first year of a state general assembly, and you know what I do for a living, most people do, that when we get to about July, things pretty much drop into neutral until sometime late September, October, maybe even sometimes as late as November, for them to come back. They finish a state budget, and they all go home for the summer to go to the parades and the fairs and the events and actually to, you know, well, since we're only a part-time legislature, go back and do the things that they're supposed to do in their real lives. You know, everything from doctors, lawyers, and bankers to, you know, activists and lobbyists on their own right.
Yeah.
In certain areas. And so we've got, we kind of went a little long in the tooth this year, because, well, Chuck, we've got a situation in the state that, needs attention. And yeah, you know, people say, yeah, there's a lot of those issues in the state. Well, this was the biggest one, which was we have a constitutional requirement in Ohio that when a budget is put in place for the spending of government for a 2-year period, it has to balance. That's, you know, we're one of the few states, I think, that still hold to a balanced budget. And that's fine, and we should, because God help us where we'd be at if we let these guys just deficit spend all the time. And let's not kid ourselves, they are deficit spending.
Of course.
They just call it a balanced budget.
Yeah, it's the John Kasich it's a John Kasich approach to a quote-unquote balance the budget. It's basically kick stuff down the road, put it on, take it off budget. There's all kinds of tricks you can use, and suddenly you find out you're spending way, 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 way more money than you actually budgeted for. Well, because it's not really on budget.
Well, and yeah, there's that, and you're right. This particular governor has had a lot of practice at that because that's how he quote-unquote balanced the federal budget, which is what he tried to run on when he tried to run for president last year. But he's not alone. I mean, you know,
right.
Kasich, before him Strickland, before him Taft, before him Celeste, before him Rhodes, before him Gilligan. I mean, we could go all the way back. I mean, you know, hey, John Gilligan back in the 70s, in order to balance the budget, brought in the state income tax and got it passed a legislature that didn't want it, cutting deals. So, yeah, it's nothing new. We've been doing this for decades. But this time around, that budget wasn't balancing right because revenue projections were way off. The State Office of Budget Management, which is the executive arm of the you know, economic forecasting, were missing their revenue projections on what they were going to get monthly coming in from taxes, and they were missing them, well, fairly significantly, Chuck, to the tune of, when the governor submitted his budget way back in February of this year, by the time they figured out how much they were off by going through June, that budget was over $1.2 billion too heavy. They had overestimated revenues by that were coming in by that much money. And frankly, that shouldn't be surprising to most folks. If you're paying any attention out there, you realize our economy is not as robust and healthy as some in Columbus and even in D.C. would like to let you believe that it is. So the legislature had to basically shoulder a burden, and the House kicked their version out in May, and then the Senate had to deal with it too, and they finally came back with a budget that supposedly balanced. And one of the ways they were going to balance the budget, Chuck, was to put a freeze on the expansion of Medicaid. As you know, the governor, you know, basically while saying he was opposed to Obamacare, went hat in hand to D.C. and ran around the legislature, who said no, and went to the controlling board, which is a money-releasing entity that actually is made up of legislators. Now, think about this one.
Yeah.
Controlling board's made up of legislators who told him no, and the legislature told him no back when he wanted to originally spend this thing and get Ohio into the Medicaid expansion funding. But he went around to other legislators who actually were handpicked by leadership, and actually there were a couple of people who were replaced before this particular vote, and they voted to give him the authority to go after the Medicaid expansion money. In other words, they were basically acting as a super legislature. Okay, so hey, how's that going to work out for him? Well, we're finding out, because Kasich did it. He hooked in. He got a lot. Billions and billions of dollars came into the state. They expanded Medicaid. And, of course, his same team at the Office of Budget Management and at the Office of Medicaid decided that they would project for the legislature to tell them, well, exactly how many people we were really looking at getting in this Medicaid expansion. And by their projections, we were supposed to get a little over 400,000 to sign up to be new enrollees in Medicaid, which the federal government, under this agreement with Medicaid expansion money, would pick up 95%, and then it would drop down a little bit, you know, over time, to where they were basically, they would cover 90% of the funding. Now, with regular Medicaid population that we already had, the balance was that the feds pick up 60% and the state picks up 40% of the cost. So that's what the traditional Medicaid model looked like. This model said, okay, the feds will pick up 95%, and the state only has to pick up 5%, and then after a certain time period, the state has to pick up another 5%. Oh, all well and good, except for the fact that the Department of Medicaid and the Office of Budget Management is really pretty good at missing predictions. And so when they predicted 400,000, what they actually got in the first opening period of the Medicaid expansion was 755,000 new signups for Medicaid. Well, that's a little bit beyond budget projections when you almost double the population. You miss this by a factor of about, you know, 40% that grew to. And so we have a budget problem because, well, that's an awful lot of money to spend. And there's another factor that's now involved, and that is with the changeover of administrations and the fact that the House and the Senate and the federal government and the Trump administration are possibly looking at major changes to, or, well, let's just say major changes, because let's not kid ourselves. There's only about a small handful of members in Congress in both chambers who want to repeal Obamacare. So all they're doing is tweaking around the edges, and as a matter of fact, there's an article that they will talk about in a minute that Mitch McConnell's already signaling capitulation on some of this.
Yeah.
But you may end up with a situation where, okay, our expansion population grows to 800,000 more people than, you know, are overall adding to the Medicaid rolls, and then the state ending up having to pick up not 10%, but 40% of the costs. Well, do the math, they're looking at another probably billion plus per year that the state will be short in its budget. So the House and the Senate passed a budget, and part of what they passed was a provision that said that we were going to freeze enrollment in the Medicaid expansion program. Not immediately. I mean, it would have been great if they would have said immediately starting July 1 of this year when the budget went in place. But no, they moved it to July 1st of next year. So at least for one of the 2 years of the budget, and they were going to freeze Medicaid expansion. I probably would have still gotten to 800,000 for new enrollees, but they wouldn't have had any more. Now, of course, healthcare organizations, which get most of the money, liberal groups, which always argue for more government expansion into your lives, and the governor himself, who basically created his own monster by getting into this in the first place, and through the force of his particular will, are now looking at a situation where they've got to protect it. So there were big rallies and things of that nature. When the House and the Senate passed their budget, they sent it to the governor, and the governor basically waited till the very last minute, and I do mean this, because the budget has to be in place by 12:01 a.m. on July the 1st of each, every 2 years, okay? It has to be signed, and it takes effect then. The governor signed the budget and issued the vetoes that he could, because we have line item veto authority in this state, at 11:45 p.m. on June the 30th. I saw a picture. I almost had to laugh, because here's the governor with some of his cabinet officials standing around him. And now remember, this is almost midnight on a Friday night, okay? So I tell you, these guys, none of them look like they wanted to be there. none of them liked the idea that he was, doing this deal. And, of course, he's doing this deal. Think about it, Chuck. If you sign a budget at almost midnight on a Friday night, when is someone going to get a chance to really get into it and then make commentary through the media or whatever else? I mean, what he did was he was intentionally trying to miss the weekend news cycle, because most of the programs, the Sunday programs, already schedule their people, and they tape on Fridays, or some of them tape on Saturday mornings. So he was going to miss all the talking head news cycle, and basically the only thing that the rest of the media was going to be able to publish was just some basically, boilerplate copy about him signing the budget and vetoing. Now, what he did was he vetoed 47 things in the budget. It's the most vetoes a governor's ever issued in a budget in history of Ohio, as far as everybody can tell. And, of course, one of the big things he vetoed was the freeze on the Medicaid expansion population. Well, that raised a call that the House and the Senate, now the Senate had voted, and they had voted like 24-9 for the budget. And the House voted, and it was like 59-36 or something of that nature. And they really need, in order to overturn vetoes, they need 60 votes in the House, because it's a 3/5 majority, and it's only 20 in the Senate, and they got that pretty comfortably. So the question was, are they going to come back, the House going to get enough votes to come back to override the governor's vetoes? And the answer was, on Thursday this week, yes, they did. But no, they didn't. And that's the funny thing. They only picked 11 things to override. Now, remember, there were 47 vetoes in the budget. Now, that's quite a bit, and a lot of them had to do with education, none of which the legislature took up for a veto override. And honestly, we can talk about that in another program, but there was a lot of stuff that basically school choice may be dead in Ohio now, Chuck. There was so much power and authority ceded over to the Ohio Department of Education in this budget, and by Kasich's vetoes, because the legislature was trying to rein in the department too on a few things, because they've been just as good as the OBM about doing certain things. But they couldn't touch the education portion of it, so they worked on some of the Medicaid issues, and of course about 10 or 11 of those things they overrode. One of the key ones they overrode was the ability for the controlling board to basically unilaterally give the governor what he wants. They re-exercised legislative fiat or legislative veto over what the controlling board does, which I think is wonderful, because that's a check and balance, because now it's out of whack. The governor has figured out he can use the controlling board to get what he wants. And that's not the way it's supposed to work in Ohio. We're supposed to have, checks and balances just like at the federal level. Well, okay, maybe it does work just like at the federal level. Who knows? But we've got it in here. But the one thing that the legislature didn't bring up to override, now, and Chuck, these veto overrides, it wasn't like a 60 to 39 right. vote because we have 99 members of the House. So these were 65 to 30 votes. These were 92-7-2 votes. These were, 98-0 votes to override the governor. Okay? It wasn't like it was just strictly a party line thing, but it was on some of the issues, especially around the Medicaid. But the one thing that the House Speaker, Cliff Rosenberger, didn't bring up, although he said subsequently in interviews that they have the 60 votes for it, was the freeze on the Medicaid expansion population. Now, you wonder why. His argument? Well, we want to wait to see what Congress does with what they're doing with Medicare, and we have until December of 2018 to come back and override these vetoes. And okay, technically, yeah, he's right. They do. But the point is that once it's in place and things start rolling, it makes it so much harder to get rid of it or to implement it. Really, they only have until probably, if they decide that it's become a hot potato enough, you'll probably see it happen before primaries next spring in order for them to be able to act like they're actually trying to control things. It didn't really wash. If you had the vote, you needed to do it.
But then
there's another school of thought, and I'm amongst that school of thought, that said it may have been just a show in the first place. Yeah, we put it in there so that people can vote on it and say they voted to freeze Medicaid, right? Which is wonderful because most people are this whole thing with the budget, and like I said, the economy is not as good as it has been. And yes, there are people, but most of the Medicaid expansion population, Chuck, are able-bodied adults who can work.
Yeah.
I mean, and when you look at, and I'm not being polemic about that. I'm not being, ideological about that. I'm just looking at the data. Most of these, the expansion population, because Medicaid expanded so that it went up to 138% of the poverty level, are usually adults who are single, who are able to work. Now, most people, when they figure that out, aren't supportive of this expansion. They think that, wait a minute, if they're able to work and they're single adults, they don't have dependent kids who need it. They're not pregnant women. It's mainly able-bodied adults. And really, the other side of that coin is, it's able-bodied adults who are doing illegal drugs.
Yeah.
This is your heroin population. Now, granted, we have to lock in and try to curb this heroin issue, but you don't curb it by just spending money and putting people on free health care so that they can go and get their, Suboxone or their Naloxone shots for free on the taxpayer. You take care of the problem like I just saw this morning, like the Pike County Sheriff down, where the Roden murders happened.
Yeah.
They just busted 22 people in a drug ring that was being run by someone who's in prison in Ohio. The head of the ring was behind bars running the ring. 22 people. I think they said there was 23 pounds of meth, heroin that was laced with fentanyl because they were using it to get rid of snitches, as they said, and tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars of cash and weapons and everything else. 22 people just got arrested in Pike County for running a drug ring. That's how you take care of the heroin and the opiate addiction problem in this state. You cut off the supply pipeline. People have given Mike DeWine a bunch of grief about him, fact that he's suing pharmaceutical companies. Point is, he's making a point, and I actually agree with the point, that you got to cut it off at the source, and the biggest source of most of this stuff is not the guy sitting here in their home, kitchen cookers, making meth. It's the folks up at pharmaceutical companies pumping out painkillers and getting doctors to prescribe them like they're Pez candies.
You and I disagree on this. I think this is grandstanding extraordinaire on the part of Mike DeWine.
No, don't get me wrong, Chuck. I know it's grandstanding, but I actually think it's grandstanding that actually has a legitimate point.
And I have a problem. I'm on the other side of this. Are painkillers overprescribed? Yeah. When you do surgery on somebody and put them on a painkiller for 3 months on an opiate and then tell them they just flat out can't get any more, That's an issue. Now, I'm yes. a person who was in a rather serious automobile accident, 30 some odd years ago. And I was put on opiates. I was taking opiate injections for pain. And the first thing that came to my mind was, you know, I've known too many people that have had an issue with this. This is back in the 80s, and to say that I was completely cognizant of what was going on at that time would be incorrect. But my first thing was, you know, if I can stand the pain for a while, I can reduce the amount of opiate that I need, and therefore I won't end up having a problem at the end of this thing. And it turned out that, they had me set up for 3 or 4 shots a day of either Dilaudid or Demerol. And I started I was down to 1 shot a day right before I went to sleep. And they're like, does it not hurt? And I go, yeah, but it doesn't hurt so much that I can't bear it. Now, you know, if you guys are going to cut me open again, then I'm going to need you to up the prescription. Because I had a couple of surgeries and I had been refusing painkillers and they didn't up my prescription. So I got operated on a Friday and I suffered for 2.5 days while we waited for the doctor to get back and change my prescription. By the time he got back, I was back to 1 day. They had to get I was able to sleep and all that, and I started refusing painkillers again. A lot of people don't have the willpower. You know, they feel a little twinge. Oh, I better go, you know, take a Dilaudid, or I better go take a Demerol, or I better take an oxycodone. No, man, you're going to end up addicted that way, and that's the problem. That doctors aren't being careful in talking to people about the very real possibility of becoming addicted to the stuff. And so there's an individual responsibility here. Are there doctors who are completely irresponsible and feeding into the whole opiate addiction problem? Oh, you bet there are. And you know why? Because they're too busy. And because there's a shortage of doctors. Thank you, Obamacare. And fewer and fewer doctors coming out of med school. Thank you, Obamacare. Because, you know, who wants to come out of med school with $500,000 in debt and have your income restricted? This is only another hunk of the cycle. And I really think that suing drug companies is, I understand they're the source of the drugs, and drug reps are the source of, a lot of ill. I've dealt with drug reps before. Their whole thing is, you know, they want to keep, taking river cruises in Europe and that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
And so are they as careful as they should be with warning doctors about what's going to happen with some of this stuff? And the answer is no. And doctors, okay, if you think your doctor really understands drugs, he doesn't. He or she does not. They don't know really what's going on. They rely on, they don't know what it costs, because they write a prescription for it and you take it to the drugstore and your insurance company either pays it or pays some percentage of that cost. I have been prescribed medicines and told the doctor flat out that I am self-pay, and I need something to be, you know, relatively affordable. And she says, I don't think this stuff is too expensive. And I go get the darn stuff filled, and it's $600 a month.
Yeah,
and I go back,
that's
and
not too expensive.
I go back and report to the doctor what the actual cost is, and she goes, "I had no idea. I had no idea." She goes, "I thought it might be, you know, $60 or $70 a month." Well, even that's like ridiculous when you're writing a 3-month supply. Nonetheless, I went to pick up a prescription once, and she had written me a prescription for $1,800 worth of this drug.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, and I go to the drugstore to pick it up, and they go, "We didn't fill that." Okay, why not? And they said, "Because it was going to come to $1,860. And I'm like, "Oh, well, I'm glad you didn't fill it, because you'd be putting it back in the bottle."
And that's exactly,
that's
they knew
exactly
that
what they
like,
did.
Yeah, we don't want to do that.
Yeah, I went back to metformin, which cost me, you know, $30 a month or something. But this is part of the problem, Barry, and I think that targeting drug companies, because what will happen is this will actually run the cost of opiates back up.
Which I think is another reason why they're doing it. Now, if you remember, we've spent the last couple of years as a legislature in Ohio getting tough on opiates, you know. You know, it's sort of like the we did DARE education for years. Now we're wondering why we have an opiate crisis.
Yeah.
But you know, we're getting tough on opiates, and so they went after the quote unquote pill mills. And so a number of doctors around the state who were basically writing thousands of prescriptions a month for painkillers are being shut down, sent to prison, etc. They're looking at anything they can do, and again, you're right. It's grandstanding. I don't disagree with that because he's running for governor, and yeah. It thinks it's a, you know, it's a winning proposition to grandstand on going after pharmaceutical manufacturers. But you have to also understand too, Chuck, these pharmaceutical manufacturers, they really, I mean, they have to look at the data and statistics that are coming out. They have to look at the idea that this stuff is creating massive amounts of problems. And they still pump it out and pump out new ones as fast as they can pump them out, because it's really you know, that there comes a time, and you and I both know this. You know, we're both capitalists. We both believe in the free market, but there comes a time when the market has to self-regulate in the best interest of the public. And I'm not sure that the cost-benefit analysis is working in the right direction for the pharmaceutical companies.
What?
I believe that they're ignoring the cost because of the potential profit line benefits, more so than not.
Yeah.
And yeah, folks, I know I'm starting to sound like a liberal, but
no.
I'm really not, because, you know, we've had a situation for decades, and, you know, Chuck and you and I have talked about this, that these pharmaceutical companies can, like, basically write $10 million off and get a new drug approved almost immediately.
Oh.
You know, going through the quote unquote clinical trials garbage. You know, because they've got the money to do it, and the FDA is complicit in it. And so they pump garbage out. I mean, hey, look at Gardasil. Let's you know, we've been fighting that one for a while, the HPV vaccine. It's killing girls. You know?
Yep.
It's lethal. But it got approved. Why? Because the pharmaceutical company that manufactured it had enough money.
I'm gonna
push it.
I'm gonna interject one thing. I would tell you folks, go to www.principledpolicy.com and do a search on Gardasil. The Institute for Principled Policy led the charge several years ago to keep Gardasil from becoming a required vaccine in Ohio. Why did we do that? Well, there's a good reason for that. A, we knew that there were major problems with it, and that's becoming more and more obvious that we were correct. And the reason was there is a provision in the Patriot Act that if a vaccination can be made mandatory, what it that does instantly is kicks in an indemnity from lawsuit for the drug company that manufactures it. Why do you suppose a drug company would want to be indemnified against suit for damages caused by their vaccination if it was perfectly safe?
Because there's no vaccine that's perfectly safe.
Let's just
be quite honest.
Exactly.
Between the active ingredients in a vaccine and the adjuvants, which includes mercury, aluminum, thimerosal. I mean, you go down the list of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean,
flocculated aluminum, thimerosal. It's other problems in that. A lot of these are grown on a culture, and alongside the vaccine, the good stuff, a lot of times things like mycoplasmas will grow, and mycoplasmas have the uncanny ability to squeeze through microfiltration. These are usually sterilized using a microfiltration technique, and mycoplasmas have the uncanny ability to squeeze right through those micro, because they don't really have a cell wall. They're like a gel, and they just sort of squeeze through things. There's another thing I want to bring up about this that you brought up.
Sure.
Barry, you and I, yes, we are definitely free market, but we're free market in a biblical sense.
Amen.
I know that a lot of people out there, and this is a big bone of contention in the Christian community right now, because for some reason people are under the impression that Jesus was a socialist. I always laugh about that. The First Church of Jesus Christ Socialist. The fact is that you cannot reconcile the Old Testament and the New Testament if you think Jesus was a socialist, because the Old Testament is a free market, proponent, insofar as that free market has a moral structure.
Yes.
The problem with the free market is you have to have morality and self-control attached to it, or what happens? You create a power vacuum when people refuse to, companies, people, all kinds of things, refuse to regulate themselves. What happens? There are immediate calls for somebody in government, as if government is somehow more naturally moral, to regulate industry. What's the whole thing in all over the Old Testament about honest weights and measures? What's that all about? It is about self-regulation in a free market.
Yes, it is. Because it didn't say the government was supposed to come in and regulate that.
It doesn't say the king.
Yeah,
it doesn't say the king, and it doesn't say the judges should come in and regulate it. The judges have to get involved, and by the judges, I mean the biblical judges who were essentially did just that. They judged cases like Moses in the book of Exodus. What they would do is come in and judge cases, and they take a look at the equipment that people were carrying around to see if they had honest weights and measures. Why? Well, there's always a need sometimes for somebody to come in and take a look and make sure you're doing it right. It's when the regulators decide that they can decide how you're supposed to do it right, and to add law upon law upon regulation to suddenly make you do things that are absurd, because they like the idea of 100% safety. And Barry, let me ask you, is there any guarantee of safety in anything?
Well, no, not really, because especially not 100% guarantee, because that's just not humanly possible. You know, we live in a fallen world, Chuck. We don't live in a perfect world. And so there are things that are going to happen that are going to create issue.
Listen, I know a guy once that bought one of those big giant gallon tubs of ice cream, right? And he bought fudge ice cream because he loved the big hunks of fudge in it. So he gets home and he starts dishing it out. He's like, I'm going to have a big dish of ice cream with a big hunk of fudge. And he starts digging in and he hits this piece of fudge and he's like, oh man, feel that. That's a giant hunk of fudge. And he keeps digging and it's bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And finally he digs the ice cream out from around it, and it's an O-ring from a filler head.
Oh no.
Look.
Oh,
that,
no.
Yeah.
Talk about disappointment.
Yeah, that kind of stuff does happen. Now what did he do? He put all the ice cream back in the bucket and took it back to the store and said, you know, you probably shouldn't sell these with the O-ring in it. And they were very gracious and accommodating. And he got more ice cream than he originally bought. But the fact is that, you know, what could have been done to prevent that? Well, honestly, probably
quality control, maybe.
Probably nothing, honestly.
Yeah,
because,
probably nothing. Yeah, and accidents will happen. That's
yes,
for sure.
Yeah, and that's the bottom line. Sometimes bad things are going to happen. That's not the case with opiates. Is there a little bit of collusion? Are the drug companies happy to be selling a lot of product? Yeah, they are. Why? Because they need to recover their development costs, and make a profit, because they gotta pay the salesman enough to take that European river cruise vacation.
Indeed.
But that being said, by the way, your estimate of $10 million, oh man, yeah. you are a dreamer. It costs billions to develop a drug through the clinical trial stage.
Right, it does. But if you can get the FDA to approve it by spending $10 or $15 million,
oh yeah, oh gosh,
and get it to market without having to go through as many of those clinical trials, it's worth it to you to get it to market.
There are so
many, Jack, let's not kid ourselves. You see the plethora of new drugs that come to market, and I'm sorry, but I find it intensely humorous to see on either on TV or magazines or anywhere else. You got this. Oh yeah, well, take the purple pill or the blue pill or the yellow striped candy looking pill for your little things like your ED or whatever it is. And then there's this list of counter effects. I mean, I just went. I had to go through the healthcare system here in the last month, the end of May, for a little issue. I found out that I have arthritic gout. Don't like it. It's, you know, but I'm changing my diet and things to try to get on top of it. Haven't quite gotten there yet, but we're getting there. It's the reason why I've been a little bit lower key, and I'm really looking forward to summer and not having to tromp around in Columbus all the time. But, you know, when they wrote these prescriptions for me for a couple of things, to deal with the gout and some and a related issue, I'm looking at the list because they print out a fact sheet with the. And I asked for it. I asked for the product information sheets. Always ask for that when you
always get it. Yeah, always get it.
Always get the product information sheets and read them. I mean, it's a lot of small print, and it looks like it's thick, but. Chuck, the list of on this one thing that was supposed to deal with, you know, just touching on the gout. I mean, the side effects were anything from mild stuff like potentially diarrhea, et cetera, to death. That was one of the side effects that could happen with an adverse reaction to the medicine was death. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, okay. I think I can live with hobbling around on one foot or walking and feeling shooting pain up my leg with the other foot.
Well,
I'm not so sure I can live with dying.
Well, look at some of the ads. I'll be quite honest, Barry. It's a new experience for some of us who are older to notice that all of a sudden drugs being advertised on television, and there's a reason for that. There used to be a sort of an unwritten rule that you only advertised drugs in professional journals. And I can remember going to the doctor's office and picking up, I must have been really, really, really bored because I'd pick up a copy of JAMA, which is the Journal of the American Medical Association. And I'd thumb through there and there'd be all kinds of ads for drugs. My family, and full disclosure, is my uncle and my grandfather both worked for Upjohn, which doesn't exist anymore, got bought out. But Upjohn Corporation, which was a drug company for years and years, decades. I think my grandfather worked at Upjohn for 35 years or something, if not longer. My uncle, very similarly, and both retired from there. That being said, they constantly were talking about such and such a company as an ethical house. Well, an ethical house is a drug company that only did advertise. They did no direct marketing. Well, gosh, drugs all the time now get direct marketed. Why is that? Well, because doctors have lost their distaste for it. Because I can tell you that if a company went outside the ethical marketing strategy, and that was, you know, again, only in professional journals and through the auspices of the drug representative, if they went outside that, they would not buy that drug. They would not prescribe it. Most doctors, only a few doctors really dispense from their office. A lot of times they'll give you a sample. I know my doctor, when I go in there, she'll throw me like big handfuls of samples because A, they have them, and B, she knows that I'm self-pay. My insurance company doesn't pay for stuff, so she'll give me a big handful of stuff, and it lasts for, you know, a couple of months sometimes. And that's fine. But most doctors would not write a prescription for a non-ethical marketed drug. Okay? That stigma has passed. Now you'll see stuff for instance, psoriasis. Plaque psoriasis or something. Which, you know, is uncomfortable. It's itchy. It's not attractive. It's ugly. You know, people think you've got the plague or, you know, leprosy or something. Yeah. But nonetheless, you start reading the side effects. Oh, look, you'll die of liver damage. But your corpse will be very attractive.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's basically the bottom line.
Direly leave a pretty corpse, yeah.
Yeah. And it's one of those things. You start reading the side effect, the possible side effects. Now, does everybody get the side effects? No. But let me tell you something. People that are sensitive to things, my wife, for instance, just went through a big round of these tests. Oh, gosh, this, and this, and We had to negotiate with the again, because we're self-pay and we're through the Samaritan Ministries. Samaritan agreed to to cover a lot of this, her blood test work. But the first thing, the doctor ordered these tests, we go in and start pricing it. And that's something you do, folks. When you pay for it yourself, you start pricing and negotiating prices. The first time, all the tests that she wanted was $1,800.
Mm-hmm.
Just for the blood test, right? So yeah. We go back and we talk to some people and they say, well, okay, have this taken off, this. Have you had a full CBC recently? Yes. Okay, take that off. Blah, blah, blah. We got it down to $466 or 400 and some odd dollars. Okay,
yeah,
fine.
Sure.
That's a lot better than $1,800. Okay, so we go in. She has this blood test and we get a bill from the testing company for another $1,100. Okay.
Okay.
What's this about? Yeah, well, like, okay. she had a borderline blood test that led to the idea that possibly she might have SLE. If you don't know what SLE, it's systemic lupus erythematosus. It's also called lupus.
Okay.
All right. Well, they did another test, which was not authorized, which was the $1,100, to find out if it was. There are four different types of things. And also, if you don't necessarily have SLE, you can have drug-induced rheumatoid arthritis or just plain old rheumatoid arthritis. There is a place where below a certain line it's rheumatoid arthritis, above a certain line it's lupus. Okay.
Yeah.
She comes out right smack in the middle, right in between. So they ran this other test to find out what it was. Well, guess what? Drug-induced SLE or rheumatoid arthritis. And we're like, drug-induced? Uh-huh. We're drug-induced. We just started looking at the drugs. And my wife does a little research, which, folks, you have to do when you do this yourself. Yes, you do have to do some work when you're on your own, when you're paying on your own or on a system where someone else, you share expenses. You have to do some of your own work, and it's not easy. But my wife sat down, and she discovered that she was on a drug. The doctor had her on a drug for blood pressure that she should not have been on because she's allergic to sulfa drugs. And it said right in there, do not use this if you are allergic to sulfa drugs. And my wife is deathly allergic to sulfa drugs. Like face swell up, you know, airway close, kind of. And she's also... got other allergies to things like lisinopril, which is a blood pressure medicine. So what do we find out? We spent all this money. These doctors all go into a panic and send us off to have all these tests run at expense to us and expense to other people because they didn't know about drug interactions that they should have known. Now, they know some of it. I'm not saying they're completely ignorant, but they don't know the drugs as well.
Okay, now that gets me to an axe to grind, and that is, well, I think we have a situation, Chuck, where our medical education is failing. We become so specialized in medicine that many people who are coming out of these med schools don't have any generalist knowledge because they're not required to do so by, you know, virtue of the specialization that they want to get into. I remember, you know, when you had the good old GPs, the general practitioners, and the family doctors, they really kind of, many of them probably didn't, but some of them knew their stuff and they studied or they were required to when they went to their medical schools to know these things about drugs and interactions and the chemical reactions in the body and things of that nature. And I'm not sure that is in our mad rush to get more, plastic surgeons out there or more heart specialists or more specialists. I mean, you name the bodily, dysfunction specialty, you know, because that's where the money is, Chuck. You can't have your house in the Hamptons and your beach house in Bermuda being a GP anymore. You know, you have to be a heart specialist or a brain surgeon or some exotic disease specialist And that's really where the push comes.
I'm right.
Nobody wants to come out of school owing $500,000 or more dollars in debts and work in a practice where you're only maybe clearing $100,000 a year.
There's two other factors here, and I'm gonna call you out a little bit on this. Just a little.
Go ahead.
I have specialized knowledge in this area because I have a family full of pharmacists. I'm going to go back 50 years to give you an example. My grandfather got in trouble, got called before the medical board. My grandfather was a registered pharmacist. He got called out on the before the medical board, and this kind of plays into some other stuff that you and I are dealing with, because he refused to fill a prescription written by a doctor. Now, why did he refuse to fill that prescription? Because my grandfather, as a trained pharmacist, and my father ran into the same situation. So, and going back 40 and 50 years ago, this doctor had written a fatal combination of drugs.
Uh-huh.
And my grandfather says, sure, I'm not filling that. Because if I give this to you and say, you know, he didn't tell the customer why. He goes, I can't fill that. And nobody else should fill it either. It's basically, don't go someplace else and try to have it filled. It's basically what he told this person. Well, the doctor filed a complaint with the medical board. So I believe he filed it with the pharmacy board. So my grandfather goes in for his pharmacy board hearing, and he laid out the prescriptions that were written. And essentially, the pharmacy board laughed the doctor out of the room. Why did they? Were they able to laugh the doctor out of the room? Because the doctor did not know pharmacology. You cannot blame a doctor for not knowing pharmacology. Should he have been cognizant? Yes. But there were two safeguards in the chain. What's the other safeguard? The pharmacist does know pharmacology. He knows
right,
it inside.
Absolutely.
He knows it inside and out. Now, do pharmacists in modern times know as much about pharmacology? I'll be quite honest, I don't think so. They're very reliant on computer programs these days. When my father and my grandfather and my uncle got their pharmacy degrees, you had to know how those drugs were going to interact. You had to know the chemistry. And you had to be able to predict, based on your knowledge of the drug, what would interact. And the fact is that I don't think either doctors or pharmacists necessarily have all that skill. And the drugs are getting more and more and more chemically complex. And we're relying
I'll give you that. But the other side of that coin is there should be at least a basic course in pharmacology.
Oh, they take it.
Even for someone who's going to be a joint specialist. I mean, you know, they really need to have at least a common knowledge of some general issues in relation to that.
Believe it or not, they do. They do. Even the GPs.
Okay.
The GPs, everybody is supposed to have several units in pharmacology. The problem is several units in pharmacology just doesn't get it when you are being we'll go back to there's not enough doctors, so they're too busy. And B, they're totally reliant on these drug reps to tell them what's it that's the problem you're running into, Barry.
And now that gets me back around to the idea that if that's the case, then maybe Mike DeWine's not so wrong in going after the drug companies.
It's a good thing we have these discussions, because I still think Mike DeWine's wrong on this. The individual drug reps have to let the doctors know, look, if you use these two drugs together, you'll see that on these unethical ads on TV. And by say unethical, that means it's not ethical marketing. I'm using a term. And what I mean, you'll see, don't take if blah, 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 blah. You're taking blah, blah,
sure,
blah, or this and this and this and this.
If you're taking nitroglycerin tablets, don't take this because your head will blow off.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing, because basically what will happen is your liver will, your livers or kidney will explode, and you will die, or you'll need a liver and kidney transplant. You know, it's sort of like if you think about it, Tylenol. A lot of people take Tylenol. I will not take Tylenol, and I will stick with if I have to do that, which I do only rarely. I either use ibuprofen or aspirin, good old aspirin. And I'll tell you why. Because in Tylenol, believe it or not, the fatal dose and the effective dose aren't that far separate. Yeah, they're not separated by enough, in my opinion. And what you'll get sometimes, you'll hear stories about some young girl will, desiring attention in college, will take a handful of pills. And what will they pick? They'll pick Tylenol in a lot of cases. So they have to go get their stomach pump and blah, blah, blah. You know, they want attention, so they do a fake suicide attempt. Well, what they very often find out is that they go to the hospital and have their stomach pumped, and somebody does a liver test and says, you've really, 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 really damaged your liver to the point where you might need a liver transplant.
Yeah.
And, you know, all for this over-the-counter pain medication. Now, that being said, ibuprofen, you can have major kidney trouble, and it causes internal bleeding if you take too much of it. That's why I use it sparingly. Like, maybe once every 4 or 5 months, I'll work in the yard and feel really, 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 really sore. And I'll take some aspirin or some, you know, ibuprofen before I go to bed, and I can sleep all night and wake up in the morning, and I've only got residual muscle soreness. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
But that being said, there's a lot of stuff out there that is just simply, I'm amazed, to be quite honest, about the Plan B abortion system, which is essentially it's a home abortion kit.
Yes.
That thing is dangerous as anything. I'm serious. If you don't use it exactly per instructions, you can end up in a major world hurt, and you can anyway if you cause major uterine bleeding and all kinds of other stuff. I'm amazed that, you know, how politically correctness sometimes overrides common sense.
Right, exactly.
And again, that's part of the problem, again, in the opiate field.
Mm-hmm.
The doctors, yeah, are there pill pushers? Oh, you know there are, Barry. There are guys out there that are desperate for whatever. They have their own opiate addiction. They have a gambling addiction. They have all kinds of different things that can happen. And their ethical system inside the profession, the medical boards, very often do nothing. Nothing. They'll give them a slap on the wrist when they get caught and let them keep their license. No, 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 no. And you know, will it contribute more to the shortage of doctors or remove these guys? Yes, but who cares? I mean, they are basically pill merchants.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
So part of my problem is that Mike DeWine is not going to the medical board and said, do your job and shut these guys down.
Well, you know, when it gets right down to it, the medical board has been doing a little bit of that, but you're right, they haven't done enough. Now, again, I want to be real careful here because I'm not necessarily advocating for government to get any bigger. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
But, you know, there comes a situation when there's abuse. That's what, you know, government is biblically mandated for, is to punish evil and to reward
the
good.
Evildoer. Yeah, that's right. Yep.
And there's not an awful lot of that side of it really going on. The punish evildoers doesn't seem to work as well because of how much, you know, they can finesse and they can, you know, get like good attorneys who can argue like esoteric points of law that may or may not be legitimate.
Yeah.
But they'll argue them anyway. And there's not a whole lot of rewarding good either. I mean, yeah. Let's take a look at this. And this gets us all the way back around to what I was talking about earlier about the Medicaid expansion freeze. the governor's office was arguing that they were opposed to the expansion freeze because 500,000 people would lose health insurance. Blah, 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 blah.
Okay.
How would they lose health insurance, Chuck? Because the goal of the Medicaid program, this expansion population, was to give people insurance in order to get them on their feet so that they could then turn around and get back to work or whatever and find insurance in the private sector. But yet the governor's arguing that, 500,000 people will drop off the rolls and won't be able to get back on. That's their problem with the expansion freeze. They're expecting cyclical. They're looking for cyclical.
Yeah.
They want people to get on it for a while, run out their eligibility, drop off, and then reapply and get right back on it. Maybe in John Kasich's world that's the goal, but I think in anybody else's world, your goal is not to be on the government dole. I mean, gee, didn't we do welfare reform here? I know it's been in distant memory for most people. But in the last 20 years, we did a big thing called welfare reform where we got tired of people being on the government dole for generations and having no, legitimate incentive.
Well, there's no exit strategy, right.
And no exit strategy to improve themselves or to raise themselves out of their, condition they find themselves in. And yet here we are going around with Medicaid with health insurance, and we're basically doing the same thing. We're going to expand the eligibility population and give able-bodied people free health care and then argue that we can't freeze it because then we won't be able to keep them on it.
Yeah. Well, of course, there is no such thing as free health care. Somebody pays. Guess who pays?
The taxpayer pays.
Let's personalize a little bit. You pay. You, the listener, you pay. If you pay taxes, you pay. Now,
right.
People will sit there and go, well, I pay taxes. Yeah, you pay sales tax and that kind of thing, which is not really what we're talking about here. We're talking about income taxes and serious, heavy business-type taxes. That's what we're talking about. And you have states that are going bankrupt from this kind of thing. Illinois just raised their income tax by something like 38% or something.
Yes.
Really ridiculous, because they had two choices: cut spending or increase taxes. Guess what they picked?
Well, of course, and of course they were sitting there, I think, with some 20-some billion dollars in pension benefits for government employees that they had no ability to pay.
Right. Again, it's the pension mandate. Here's the problem: when you develop the welfare state, and all this idea about state pensioners and people on welfare and Medicaid and all these programs in which people get money, food stamps, that kind of thing. Once you take those people off, you basically cut them off from these free benefits that they've had. What do? They rebel. We've got so many.
Oh, sure.
We've got so many people.
And that's why you had like 300 or 400 people down at the State House on Wednesday, asking them to uphold the governor's veto of the Medicaid expansion freeze.
Yeah, because they were about to fall off the dole.
But a funny part about that was they figured it out. About 160 of those people at the State House all worked for one company, CareSource out of Dayton, who's one of the biggest recipients of Medicaid money.
Yep, that's what you find.
One of the biggest MCOs in the state. Their bottom line. So they sent their I think it was an all company. They all came up to do this rally against freezing Medicaid expansion.
Yep. Well, listen, we're about out of time, but de-jargonized MCO.
That's a managed care organization.
There you go.
It's the health insurers, and it's not just the Medicaid insurers. There's another piece, and it's a tax increase. And yes, the legislature voted to override the governor's veto of a tax increase because it's a fee increase of $200 million per year on these health insuring corporations or the MCOs. that will be passed along to all of us in your health care insurance.
Yep.
$200 million for 5 years, so it's a $1 billion tax increase. But the legislature could come up with the votes to override the governor's veto of that piece.
Okay. That being said, we are now out of time. You know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.